Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast from The Sober Club. I'm Jenny Lee Grace, and this is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. We'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment. And there's inspiration from quitlet authors, experts, and sober heroes. Hi, and welcome to the podcast. This is Janie Lee Grace with Alcohol Free Life. Thank you so much for joining us and being part of the podcast. Gosh, it's been another really busy week. Had another few events for Children in Need. Had great fun at a BBC event at the weekend with Michael Ball hosting. Raised so much money for Children in Need. It was unbelievable. And everyone has been just in love with Rylan. What an incredible job he did. And the amount of money that he raised, it was just so great to be part of that, singing with Rylan for Children in Need. So, so I've had a lot going on. As always, and there's been some interesting stuff in the news, as usual. There always is, isn't there? But I caught sight of a really interesting piece in the Mail the other day, and it was written by the science correspondent, and the title was "If Your Partner Likes a Drink, You Probably Will Too." And they say that opposites attract, but when it comes to alcohol, many of us seem to end up with a partner who shares our drinking habits. What they've basically done in this piece is that they've studied people's genes, and they say some people have a mutation in their DNA that makes them enjoy alcohol. And if you have it, your partner is more likely to have it too. This could help to explain, they say, why drinkers tend to get together with other drinkers, and couples often seem to drink similar amounts. So this is really fascinating. It's research that's been done at Bristol University's medical school, and they're looking to examine the effects of drinking behaviour and how we select a partner. So they're looking at the genes of couples whose DNA have been sequenced on this database that they've got, and then they're looking at how our DNA affects how much we drink and the partner we choose, obviously. So they say here that they say the findings are suggesting that people will get together, as I've already said, with other drinkers. And this is bad news for those who have this genetic mutation, because it basically means that, alcoholism is going to rise. It says it's also known to be more widespread in Europeans than people from other continents, which is interesting as well. And it says here, alcoholism has already been found to have a large genetic component. I'm going to have to read that study in a bit more detail. That is fascinating. I mean, one thing I would say, just off the top of my head, is I'm sure that's true. I mean, I'm definitely not a scientist, clearly. It makes absolute sense that you have something in your DNA that might make you enjoy alcohol. However, what they don't say in this piece, or at least I haven't read the full thing, of course, but what they don't seem to be saying is the fact that your DNA is not completely set. What happens is not set. There are lots of things that you can change and shift and shape, as it were. Just like your thinking, your thought process, your brain isn't set. We know about neuroplasticity now, and it's only in relatively recent times that we've realised that we can change, and that we can have an impact on our own health and well-being, and our own thoughts, our own mental health and well-being. That we can take some responsibility for all of this stuff. And this is one area where I think this is very, very interesting research. I'm sure it's completely true. I'm sure many couples get together. Many people get together with their partners because they're drinking buddies and they like to drink the same amount. And of course, it can be a really big issue when you decide to stop drinking and your partner hasn't. It's massive, actually. It can be absolutely massive. But what's also interesting is that over time, often when one person does drink less or ditch the booze, the other person kind of catches sight of that and perhaps matches their drinking. You know, they see kind of the light at the other end of the tunnel, as it were. It's really interesting. I've seen it several times, including with my own husband, who had an off switch. He didn't have to give up at all. He was perfectly fine. He wasn't like me. But when he saw that actually you don't need alcohol at all, it kind of changed his approach. And I've seen this in many people. I think Annie Grace talks about this. We mentioned it in the podcast interview with Annie Grace. She said a very similar thing. So while I understand the premise of the article, I don't think it means anything is set in stone. I suppose what I'm trying to say is don't let that hold you back. I've got there were some messages in the Sober Club recently where someone was really struggling because their partner drinks and really wondering what they can do. And actually the responses, including from our relationship expert, were in a nutshell that you can only care about yourself ultimately in this. Well, I don't mean care, that's not the right word, but you can only focus on yourself. You can only change, in inverted commas, yourself. But some of that will have a ripple effect. I think it's this thing of kind of shining a light that you're there as that kind of little bit of light, and maybe it will have that ripple effect to other people. And that topic brings me very nicely on to introducing my guest, because I'm really so thrilled that my guest on the podcast is Africa Brooke. She's become really a majorly leading light in the world of sobriety and influencing, particularly for millennials and younger people. She's a big Instagrammer, and she's really making waves. She's a coach, and she's doing some great work, and she has some really interesting ideas, particularly around sex and relationships. So I hope you'll really enjoy this interview. It's Africa Brooke. Africa Brooke, thank we get you on the podcast at last.
Yes.
It's so lovely to be able to chat to you. And obviously, I have seen some of your work on Instagram, and I heard you speak at the Alcohol Change Conference way back a few months ago. That was a great event, wasn't it? Really great event.
It really was.
So that was lovely to be connected with you there. And I thought it would just be great to share your story. I know that you are you're a huge role model among the sober millennials, but I think we should all get to hear your story, whatever age we are, in case we haven't connected yet. So yeah, tell us a bit about your journey. I know you work as a coach, and you're obviously a speaker. And tell us about the sober bit.
Absolutely. So first of all, thank you so much for inviting me to be on. I've been looking forward to this conversation, and I'm so glad we can finally do it. And in terms of kind of my journey into being where I am now, I would kind of say 2016 is when I got sober and it actually stuck. And I say that because I had tried to get sober 7 times before 2016, the 8th time, and I finally got the hang of it. But alcohol came into my life when I was 14 years old. And of course, at that time, it was something my peers were doing. It was just a way of trying this taboo thing you shouldn't really be doing in the park, the very kind of standard way that it usually happens in the UK.
Yeah.
And the first time that I drank, I actually blacked out. Right. And in that moment, that's when I thought it was normal. I thought it happened to everyone. And it's not something that I even spoke about to my friends, because I thought it happened to everyone, because the intention was to get drunk. It's not like we were doing it for the flavor. It's not like we were doing it for some profound reason. The intention was to get drunk. So at that time, that's when that kind of way of being got cemented in me, that every single time there's alcohol, the intention is to get drunk. Even if on a logical level, I would know that, okay, this is a baby shower, this is a wedding, this is not the kind of situation where it's necessary, that imprint was already made. And that was the way that I drank for a decade, from 14 to 24 when I got sober.
Can I just stop you there?
Of course.
Before we go any further, just to say, it always strikes me when I hear these sort of stories, and of course I hear them all the time, but still it just strikes me how bizarre it really is that, you know, we are bright people and yet we fall for this. What is that about? It's so bizarre, isn't it? That you know, if this was any kind of food that made us ill, sick or black out or have an allergic reaction, we would never touch that again.
No.
And yet with alcohol, pop straight back up and do it all again the next night.
It's
Honestly, I'm just,
over.
I constantly wonder. I constantly wonder at what how we kind of all been brainwashed. But
I
anyway,
know, I
there
know.
You go.
And you know what? That's something that I always think to myself as well. And I think for me, the reason why I was so enticed by alcohol is just, let's just be honest, by the fact that it's glamorized so much.
Yes,
that
absolutely.
There's so much money behind the advertising, yeah. The way it's made to seem.
Yeah.
And it is, we're sold alcohol as this idea of it being the social glue.
Yeah, and you're seen as something wrong with you if you don't join.
Right.
Particularly when you're young, when you're a teenager, you want to fit in.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So for me, that decade from 14 to 24 of blackout drinking, I knew instinctively that something wasn't right. I knew that I shouldn't be losing hours of my time.
Yeah.
I knew that I would find myself getting into the most dangerous situations, waking up in beds next to people that I don't even know, not sure of whether we've had sex or not. I knew that something was not right. But because it does look glamorous when you have a glass of wine, because you romanticize this idea that, oh, the weather's nice, let me just have one. But the reality is, for me and for a lot of people, one, I don't exactly. know many people that I've never seen someone have one drink and be fine with it. I just haven't seen that. And I definitely wasn't that kind of person. So in 2016, when I decided to get sober again for the eighth time, that was when I had finally just had enough. So when people ask me, when was the moment that, you know, there was not one moment. It was a collection of incidents. It was a decade of me falling, trying to get back up, and then it stuck.
But when you really think back on that and analyze
mm-hmm.
it, what was different the eighth time, apart from the fact that it was the eighth time?
Yes.
I mean, there must have been something.
Something.
Do you know what it was?
Yes. It was my relationships. I was losing everyone around me. It had been happening for about probably 5 years prior to me actually getting sober this time around. But I only had maybe two friends at the time and my partner. I had a very fractured relationship with my family. And my boyfriend at the time had kind of lovingly given me an ultimatum that things are really not going to work. Mm. And sometimes, most of the time, that is what you need to feel. You need to feel that loss. You need to feel that things around you are really starting to shift in a way that you can't avoid anymore. Mm. So even though there wasn't that kind of singular moment of being like, okay, this is it, I was finally so sick of myself.
Yeah.
And I knew that if I carry on, I will have no one. So yeah. What I always say as well is that this eighth time, it's not as if I was doing it for myself. I had this profound revelation of, okay, I love myself. Let me give myself a chance. No, I was desperate to keep the people in my life.
Right.
And that's where the kind of core difference was
right.
that time around.
So
yeah.
how did you go about it then? This time around, what did you know you needed to do? Did the idea of AA resonate with you? You know, I mean, for your age groups, for my age group, we tend to think, oh my goodness, you know, if I'm drinking too much, there is only AA. Well, fortunately, that's changing.
Right.
But certainly
yes.
a few years ago, it used to be a case of, well, if I'm drinking too much, I must be at rock bottom and go to AA. Or
yes.
I must be perfectly fine. Of course, we now know there's a huge spectrum. But what did you think of immediately as the way to start the journey?
Yeah. And you know what? That's such a good point that you make, because even in 2016, it was not like it is now.
No.
It was a very binary thing. AA or I'm fine. I just
I
just carry on. There was no gray area, which is where most of us actually are. So for me, I did consider AA because I could not think of anything else. So on the day that I decided to get sober on the 7th of November, I went to a women's meeting, an AA meeting, and even though it was wonderful and I could see other women around me, I just didn't resonate. I wasn't comfortable with saying I'm Africa, I'm an addict, because that's not a label that I attached to myself. I knew that I wasn't the problem here in that kind of way.
Yeah.
So I didn't know what else it was going to be. And the other option outside of that, that's kind of put forward, is rehab. But I knew and I could feel that that's not what I needed. It was something much more holistic, something deeper. But again, I couldn't find it. So I went online because I knew that I've always been a writer. I knew that I have so many things inside me that need to come out, and there aren't any tangible spaces for it. But by going online, I could just tell my story anonymously. I was anonymous at the time.
Oh, right.
So I just used, right.
Did you start a blog then? Did you start an anonymous blog?
So on Instagram, exactly.
Oh,
so
wow.
It was called Blackout Bell, which was a play on how I used to drink.
Wow.
And then I just kind of started writing. I started using hashtags as a way to find other people. I didn't know it was going to be what it is now. I wasn't even intentionally community building. I was just releasing. It was like a form of therapy for me. So I always say Instagram was a very big part of my healing. And it can sound so strange to say that, but it's because I couldn't find it in the outside world. The stigmas at that time and the shame that I had within myself, I wasn't willing to look for it out there. So I went online.
But that's great, isn't it? Because, you know, on lots of levels, I mean, I always tell people to write stuff down. Just the writing down is cathartic, you know, and then obviously if you can share it, then there is a sense of accountability there, you know, even if you're anonymous, there is that accountability sort of to yourself and to those people who may or may not be reading it, you know.
Exactly.
So, and who could have imagined the way Instagram has become, you know, so cool for the sober movement. I mean, you're totally rocking it there.
It's
brilliant, isn't it? It's absolutely brilliant that now this kind of thread of joy is underpinning it all. Because I know, I think that one of the, you know, as you said at the beginning, for you, it was really a case of the pain of not giving up was becoming harder than carrying on, whatever that expression is.
Exactly.
You know the one I mean.
Exactly. Yeah. No.
It's harder to stay stuck than it is to actually finally do something about it. But it's that point, it's still steeped in just goddamn misery, quite frankly, isn't it? You know, it just is at the beginning. So the really fabulous thing now is that because of the work you're doing and all these other people and all this kind of vibe, now people who are at that hideous stage, and it is tough at the beginning, there's a kind of light that they can see. That's, you know, they can see these little specks of light in the future. They've probably got no idea how they're going to get there. But they can see a light, and that's a very different feeling to just, oh my God, I don't have an option. I'm going to lose my friends and my boyfriend.
Absolutely.
I have to give up, which is just
absolutely
misery.
Wow.
So then what else did you do apart from the writing? Did you, did it flow relatively easily for you, or, you know, did the cravings come in? How was it for you in the early days?
So in the early days, for me, it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy because it required me to do a complete life overhaul. It required me to get to know myself in a way that I hadn't before. I always say I felt like a newborn baby in the body of a 24-year-old.
Well, because you didn't know who you were because you were only 14 when you started. This is the thing, isn't it? You have to relearn who you even are. How amazing.
Oh, my goodness.
But how lucky are you to have done this at 24? I'm so jealous. I wish I'd done it younger.
And I always say to people, that's why our stories, regardless of age, are so important, because it can happen at any point.
But it's never too late.
ever. And it was very difficult in the beginning because I had to change everything. You know, the people, places and things all had to change.
Yeah.
But by this time around, I wasn't romanticizing this idea that it was going to be easy. I think that's where the difference was.
Yeah.
The other seven times, the reason why I relapsed is because I had this idea that all I have to do is make the decision and then it's going to be easy.
Yeah.
And of course, it felt good for like a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks because it would feel like I'm doing this amazing thing. But I wasn't willing to really do the work and to be part of the process and to feel everything.
Yeah.
So it wasn't as easy in the beginning, this eighth time around, but because I had a space where I could talk about everything, every single time I had a craving, every single time I wanted to go to a party, every single time I had thoughts of maybe I could just have one, I even had thoughts that told me, Africa, maybe you can do cocaine instead because alcohol was your thing, but maybe you could. So I would share all of those things I felt, and the shame that I would feel when I was thinking all of these things would literally melt every single time I posted something. And the amount of people that would come in and be like, oh my goodness, you have just stopped me and saved me from having a drink today. Wow. So I knew that everything that I feel inside, the things that I feel ashamed of, that I don't want to speak about, are the very things that I need to be saying.
Yeah.
But I would say it took me about a year, and I'm always honest about that. It took me about a year for me to actually get comfortable in my sobriety. And even after that year, I would still have those moments. Maybe the weather's nice, or maybe I went on holiday for the first time and I was thinking, maybe I could drink in Madrid. And
then
I
could just,
because something is different. So I did romanticize alcohol still for a long time, although I was firm in my decision.
Yeah.
I did have thoughts of trying different drugs because they weren't the problem. Alcohol was the problem, right?
Yeah.
So it did take a while, which is why I always tell people, you see the result now of where I am, but I need to let you know that it didn't look like that always consistently for the 3 months.
I think that's really, it is such a good point. You know, I'm all about bringing the positivity, but I do like to share that it can take a long time. And I think you're right. You know, I think a year, because after a year, you've done all the firsts. You know, you've usually done the first birthday, the first party you're going to, the first, you know, whatever it is.
Yes. Whatever.
So I think your holidays are a big one, of course. Getting on a flight, you know, for a lot of people, that's a big one, isn't it? The first time I got on a flight, and how I was going to. And it's so bizarre that we just associate flights with booze.
Right?
Whatever time of day it is, you know, 7 o'clock. Oh, lovely. It's just bizarre.
But
I think that is a really good tip. You mentioned that you knew you were losing time. You know, how did you, when you were drinking, how did the time come back as it were, and how did you fill it? Were you conscious that, okay, now I've freed up some time?
So yes. So I suddenly found that I had 2000 hours in a day. So I had to decide what I was.
Can I have some of yours? I need some more hours.
They're gone now because
they're gone,
with it. But then I there was so much time. But the thing is, because by this time already, because I had tried these things, and of course I wouldn't say I did everything completely alone. For years I had already been looking at spaces like Hip Sobriety by Holly Whitaker.
Yeah.
So she would share things about a sobriety toolkit that you have to be, it's like you're going into battle. You have to be prepared for the boredom.
Yeah.
Because boredom is so dangerous. You have to be armed and equipped. So although I suddenly found that I had so much time, I knew that I finally had time to do the things that I've always enjoyed but were too hungover to do.
Yeah.
So going to museums, going to the cinema alone, going to eat alone, just inviting friends over for tea, things like that. Things that I'd always really, really wanted to do, but I prioritized the party. I prioritized what other people wanted. I was too hungover. I'd be on a come down for about 5 days. So by this time around, I was equipped for it.
Yeah.
But I did get very bored. Boredom, I became my best friend. I was bored all the time, which I always say to people, just be welcome it in and realize that you are going to get very bored. You are going to get very bored because I chased things that were always so high vibe, and just adrenaline and just debauchery, all of these things that really fed not only my ego, but just kept me on a high all the time.
Yeah.
So really slowing all of that down, I did feel bored, but that boredom allowed me to get to know myself. And I realized that I'm a very simple person.
Mm. How did the relationships pan out then? What was the situation with you? You know, you said you had a I don't know if you had a new partner or whatever. I don't know how that played out. But also, you know, as a young person, you've probably still got the dating thing kind of going on and the social, a lot of the social stuff. So how was that for you?
Yes, that was hard. That was hard in the beginning. But I'll also be very honest. By that point, I've lost so many friends that I wasn't going to be losing any more people, really. The people that were left were the people that wanted me to get sober. They wanted to see the Africa that they really knew. So although my relationship, my romantic relationship at the time, he was extremely supportive of my journey. He was not really a big drinker either. But that relationship ended up not really working because I realized I had met him at a time where I didn't really know myself at all. Mm. So I hadn't really fallen in love with the person that he truly was. Yeah. I was just always in a hazy state. And I think I just wanted someone to love me. So I'd ended up in a relationship. We had been together for 3 years. So that ended up showing me a lot just about how I like to give love, how I like to receive love, and the fact that that relationship wasn't to work. And then in terms of my family, getting sober, just we've never been more closer. It allowed me to take accountability of some of the things that I've done, to really have the conversations that were too uncomfortable to have before and to address some things. So although it was there was a lot of discomfort in the beginning, it helped me to get much, much closer to the people that were left in my life. And that partner, my ex, we're still very good friends to this day. And I don't think if I hadn't got sober, that wouldn't have happened. The relationship would have ended, but in a very different way.
Yeah. What were the kind of main benefits for you then that you saw? I mean, I'm still seeing them coming. I'm sure you are.
Right?
What were the main things for you? What was most notable?
Yeah, the main thing for me and the most important was that I was finally able to make authentic relationships. Mm. And, you know, I think sometimes even when we hear that word authentic, it can be a bit vague. But for me, this was really important because I didn't have to be drunk or tipsy to speak to people anymore. I could actually speak to someone. And if I'm laughing, if I'm having a good time, I get to remember that. It's from a place of honesty. It's because I actually am this person in this moment. Not that I'm going to wake up the next day and not remember a thing, but having someone texting me saying, oh, it was amazing to meet you. That was a great conversation.
And you're thinking,
I have, because it was like CSI all the time, trying to find out what has happened. So for me, authentic relationships was a big one. And I was able to actually start committing to things. I lost so many jobs. I was fired from so many jobs when I was drinking.
Really?
Because I always worked in hospitality and kind of fine dining. Either I would drink at work or I would end up partying with guests, which was extremely inappropriate for the environments I was working in. Or I would come to work still drunk from the night before. Just all of these things that I thought were fine. I thought I could just get away with. But this meant I was in and out of work all the time. And I tried to make that seem like it was kind of like a rebellious quirk that I could add to my personality and character, but it was just very irresponsible. So one of the biggest things for me was being able to be consistent in the kind of opportunities that I have and to actually show up for them and to commit. So commitment was one of the biggest. And intimacy, I would say, is one of the biggest. I think when we speak about sobriety, we kind of neglect intimacy.
Yeah.
Not just kind of building relationships with friends, but even just the sex aspect of it.
Yeah, definitely. I saw the post that you made, of course, became very...
Yes.
Kind of viral, didn't it, really?
Yes.
You post about sober sex. I mean, it's not something many people talk about. You have to be really quite brave to talk about that, but you know, you're absolutely right. It's a thing.
Yeah, because it's like, how do I navigate being a sexual being in this relationship? How do I start dating again? How do I even get to know my own body? There are so many things, and I think because we have so much resistance to talking about sex in general, when actually most of the sex that is happening, alcohol and drugs are involved. Most first dates are through a drink. Would you like to go for a drink? It's through alcohol. So it's actually so important that we also address the sex part of it because it's difficult. It showed up in my relationship with my ex-partner because I realized that most of the sex that we did have, I would always find a way to bring alcohol into it. Maybe we'd have a glass of wine or we'd go for dinner and then I would feel comfortable, which meant that when I got sober, we weren't sexually intimate for a long time because I didn't know what to do. Alcohol had played such a big part. It had seeped into every single part of my life, including my bed. And I had no idea. So that's also a big part that I find so important to address because it changed so many things for me. It allowed me to have true confidence without needing a drink.
Do you think that, I mean, it's such a big question, and obviously, you know, we can't make the whole podcast about it. But I mean, it really is true that most people will never have had sex sober.
Yeah.
I mean, never. You know, you can. You might be in your 50s when you stop drinking.
Yes.
And literally, you've never had that experience sober. I mean, that's a sobering thought, right?
100%.
And it's such a bizarre. I mean, I really think it can be really very traumatic for people.
Yes.
And I don't know what the process should be. I mean, what would you recommend? I suppose it really is a case of actually you need to do a little bit of work on yourself first. Mm-hmm. And I know in the piece you wrote, it's about that, you know, as you say, sort of honoring and really knowing your own body, because most of us don't.
Yes.
Most of us actually don't.
We don't. And there are, you know what? There are many reasons why we don't. And I think we should approach that with so much compassion, because there are so many systems in place that are set up for women in particular to not know their bodies in the way that we're trying to now. But I would say for that, when it comes to just sexual intimacy, that it does start with you. I think before, especially when it comes to sober sex, for me, because I had, when I drank for the first time, that's when I also had sex for the first time, and I was 14. So that imprint was made that alcohol and sex go together. This is the right. And this is the case for a lot of people. So I would definitely say that, first of all, approach yourself and this situation with compassion. Don't guilt yourself or shame yourself when you realize that, oh, I haven't actually had sober sex. Because I get messages like this all the time. But I would say it does start with you. And that sounds like such a simplistic thing to say, but it doesn't have to be deeply complex. No. It does start with you. It really, really does.
But I think there's both the emotional aspect and the actual physicality.
Yes.
In addition to all of this, you know, this new experience, also you can often find that because your brain chemistry is out of whack and everything is all so messed up, you completely lose your libido. I mean, I know a lot of women, certainly if they're coming towards the menopause, you've got all of that stuff going on, menopausal stuff coming on, saying, and so that changes everything. And then this feeling of what can often happen, I think, when you first stop drinking is you feel very raw and exposed. And so I'm sure that has an effect on libido as well. I've no idea what the answer is, or even what the question is,
but
it's just an observation. It makes it, and then it adds on another whole layer of problems, particularly if you have a partner who isn't necessarily on this journey with you. So then you've got all that shame and guilt going on, like, oh, I'm not his drinking buddy anymore or her drinking buddy anymore. Wow.
There's so much. And that, you know what, that's a good point, actually. And that's something that I realized in the beginning of my journey, because I started to think that there was something wrong with me because I didn't feel sexual, because I didn't feel aroused, because I just wasn't finding the same things to kind of ignite me. But exactly as you said, you have to realize that it's not just going to happen. You're not just going to get sober and then all of a sudden you're still sexual as you used to be. You're still that's just not what happens, because there are so many layers of emotion, so many things that are happening, so many shifts that are happening. And I think it's important for our partners or anyone else that's supporting someone who is sober to also understand that it will take a while. It will take a while, because not only are you getting to know yourself on the most basic level, like, what do I actually like? What do I like to eat? What do I like to drink that isn't water or booze, right? So at the most basic level, so it's not the right time to start throwing yourself into wanting to harness your sexuality and have all the answers. For me, it took about 2 years.
Really?
2 years until I started feeling even sexual. 2 years until I started exploring other methods of experiencing intimacy, like tantric sex, for example. I think that's perfect for people that are in sobriety, actually, because what you'll find you're looking for is sensuality. Sometimes it's not even about sexuality as in penetration, nothing like that, but you're looking for sensuality. Because if you've had a certain kind of relationship with alcohol, that means maybe the sex that you've been having probably wasn't very sensual at all. It was kind of more performative. If you don't even remember it, then if it was sensual, you don't remember. So I think what most of us are looking for is that slowness, is that sensuality, is to really reconnect with the body without feeling like you have to perform all of these things for yourself or your partner. So I always recommend a wonderful book that changed everything for me, which is called Women's Anatomy of Arousal. Mm-hmm. And it's by a wonderful doctor called Sherry Winston.
Okay.
And yeah, so this book is wonderful regardless of what gender, but I always recommend this to people who are newly sober or going on a journey of just removing these things from their life but want to connect with their sexuality and sensuality as well.
I mean, I do think this all fits around the same concept, if you like, of just needing to look perhaps for the first time at this whole thing of self-love and self-esteem.
Yes.
You know, it all sounds very woo-woo, but it's so key. And for many
it
of
is.
Us, you know, we just, it's probably the first time we've ever really thought about it. You know, I've said several times on the podcast before, but, you know, I've been steeped in the world of self-love forever and a day. I'm a Hay House author,
yeah.
You know, I'm constantly talking about it. But I didn't feel it. I didn't think
exactly.
It applied to me.
Right.
You know, everybody else, but not me.
Right.
And that was quite a shock to me when I saw it. And then I finally saw that alcohol was the missing bit of the jigsaw.
Exactly.
It was the alcohol that was stopping me from, because how could I love myself and I wasn't even being authentic to who I was allegedly meant to be?
Exactly.
Such an important point. So, or part of it, if you like.
Yeah.
You know, that. So I think, but anyway, I suppose my question is, where do people start? If this concept is completely new to them and all they know is that they feel really flipping wobbly and raw and exposed and emotional and they just have no idea where to start, what would be a good place?
I would say you do need an outlet. You do need an outlet. For some people, that might be journaling. For some people, that might be taking up some kind of hobby. For some people, it might be, I think those two things actually, because a lot of things come under there. And the reason why I say that is because you just want to show yourself that you can do something for you.
Yeah.
Something that isn't productive, something that isn't for someone else, something that doesn't have to have this massive, profound result.
Yeah.
Okay, just doing something for yourself. And I think the best way to start that journey of loving yourself and self-care is to care for yourself, even in the smallest ways. And I think journaling is a perfect way to do that. And for some people, they resist the word journaling because it can sound like, oh, journaling, where do I begin? But just free writing.
Exactly.
Just literally spilling your thoughts. It doesn't have to make sense. But just being able to see how you feel is so powerful. Mm. Being able to really see how you feel so that you can actually see that you are making progress. Because sometimes we don't realize that, okay, I actually am making progress. And when you write things down, you're able to go back and refer back to it. And I think that's a journey of really loving and caring for yourself. Because sometimes when you see the way you speak to yourself and the things that you're thinking about yourself, it can be pretty shocking to know that we think those things or say those things. So I think journaling is key.
Yeah.
Try it, free writing. It doesn't have to be anything like people say journaling needs to look like. And I think picking up a hobby, something that is just so simple. Again, it doesn't have to be complicated.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be something you show to the world or Instagram about, or just something for yourself, even if it's like an arts and crafts class or something.
I think it's such a good point. And I think it's interesting because sometimes, you know, you can find people who they, you know, you ask them, what do they do for fun or, you know, that makes the time go quickly or whatever. And there's nothing, there's not one single thing. And then you ask them, well, what do you like doing? And there's just a silence and there's not one thing in their life, nothing. They've completely forgotten how to have fun. It's incredible, actually. And I'm sure I went through a long time like that, where my life was just work and looking after the kids. And I would say, well, my work's fun and it is, but it's not the same
it's
as actually
work.
Doing something that where you lose yourself, you know, and you're not doing it for any reason. As you say, that's a really good good kind of parameter to put. You know, you're not doing it for the Instagram
exactly.
pictures or even to be productive. So that might mean, you know, you can't even count going to the gym, because if you're going
exactly.
to the gym just because you feel you have to keep your bum in shape or whatever, that's not a hobby either. You know, that's not for fun necessarily.
It's not.
Sometimes I think we have to maybe go right back to childhood and think, what did I like doing when I was a kid? You know,
yes.
was it sitting on the swing or was it what?
Yes.
What was it? It's,
yes.
I mean, it's such a tiny thing, but I think for some people it can be so massive to try and remember what that is.
For sure, because we don't know. We don't know because we're not asked these questions. And I think especially if you've started drinking from a young age, you've already found something very powerful and addictive
yeah.
to fill that gap, to fill
yeah.
that time. So when you're asked it, whether you're in your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, then you suddenly realize, actually, I don't know.
No.
I don't know what I like to do. So I think these things, I always say simple things are actually the most powerful, because when you say to people, just find a very simple hobby or just start journaling, people don't want to hear simple things. I think especially when they're on such a kind of deep, complex journey, they want a complex answer. Like, okay,
yeah.
Do something so simple,
yeah.
something that is sustainable, right? Something that you can actually do day to day, week to week, month to month, year to year. And it doesn't feel like work. It just feels like this thing that you do for yourself to just pull back into yourself, something that isn't a bath,
yeah.
something that isn't all of these things you do to your body, but something that goes inside you,
yeah.
right? So I think the simple things make a massive difference.
Yeah.
They do.
So true. So how is the scene for the sober millennials? It's good, isn't it? It really seems to be totally rocking. I think it's amazing.
Is it
true, these reports that we read that a lot of millennials are choosing not to drink, or is that not strictly
yeah.
true?
You
do.
It's true, for sure. There's also another side to that, but I think in terms of alcohol, 100%, because we've seen wellness in general take off
yeah,
in a way
true.
that has never happened before.
No.
People are now more health conscious than ever. We have kind of environmentalism where people are now looking at what that looks like in different aspects.
Yeah.
People are starting to really see through the alcohol industry, how it's marketed towards women, how it's marketed towards millennials, how it's marketed towards older women, all of
yeah.
these things, right? People are really starting to see through those things. And I think because we are in the information and digital age, we no longer are kind of just have to take what we're
yeah,
given.
Exactly.
You're able, right? You're
answer
able to
back.
Find out. Exactly. You can literally answer back.
Yeah.
If BBC News posts something on Twitter, you can write back to them.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
I think that's brilliant. You know, people,
yeah.
you're right. They're getting called out now, aren't they? They're getting
yes.
called out on some of this stuff, which is
yes.
great. And a lot of that
yes.
happens on Instagram, actually. People post
so
these
much.
Things they've seen and you know, and there'll be a whole, I mean, I don't know whether it makes a difference to the big corporations. I mean,
it
we'll
does.
See, won't we? You think so?
Yeah, I think it's slowly happening, because if we see the shift that has happened with sobriety just in the past 2 years.
Well, certainly
the
rise in the alcohol-free drinks.
Exactly.
That's kind
exactly.
of really shone a light on it, because
yeah.
they wouldn't have been producing those if they didn't think they
for
were going to
sure,
sell.
For sure. And now I've noticed that in the past couple of years, especially, you no longer see kind of in magazines so many things about how red wine is good for you, about how white wine is good for you.
Mm.
Those things are really on the decline. So when they do happen, they're really called out
they
on
get
those
called
things.
Out. Mm.
Yeah, so I think it's slow. It's definitely shifting, for sure.
That's good.
For sure.
What do you think then, if we had a conversation in 10 years' time?
Yes.
How different will the scene be?
Oh my goodness. I think it's going to change so much.
Yeah.
I think we are going to see more sober people than ever. I know at the moment there's this idea of kind of being sober curious, but I think we're even going to move completely from that into people being completely sober, because I think with the idea of being sober curious, that directly translates to moderation.
Mm.
And the truth of the matter is not many people can moderate successfully.
What's
so I
your,
think a lot of...
When you say that though, then you say you don't think the kind of mindful drinker concept works for many people.
I think it's a great concept, and I think it's a fantastic place to begin. And I think the Sober Curious movement in general, I think that's a really good space, because as long as we're getting people to question and think about their relationship with alcohol, that's amazing. But the truth of the matter is, and because I speak to so many people globally all the time, I think some people romanticize this idea of mindful drinking when the truth is that they can't be mindful. Yeah. Because for most people, to even get to that point where you're considering maybe it needs to be mindful, that means there's
there's an issue. Exactly.
There's an issue.
you are right. I mean, I happen to know someone who is, what I would describe him as a mindful drinker, but he wouldn't describe himself as a mindful drinker because he never thinks about drinking. He just can drink if he wants one. And if he doesn't want one, and it might be 3 months, and he might have two in a weekend, or he might even go to a party and have a whole bottle, but then he won't think about it for another 3 years. So it's so not an issue.
So, and I think there are people like that, but unfortunately, that is not the common story. And I think we need to be very honest. So I think the mindful drinking movement is super important because it's allowing people to see that. Yeah, okay,
it's a fantastic introduction, isn't it?
There we go. But I think in 10 years, we will see so many sober people. I think a lot of things will be going into play, similar to what we were hearing at Alcohol Change. I believe kind of the way alcohol is just put out into the world, it's going to change. Even the laws around it, I know within the next decade, it will absolutely change. And I think, of course, with what's happening in the UK with Brexit and all of that kind of stuff, I think the way alcohol is brought into the UK, that's going to change a lot as well. But ultimately, I think in terms of the movement, I think we will see more sober people than ever, because what has happened in the past 2 years, it's just phenomenal.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant. It's so great to talk to you. We could chat for hours, couldn't we?
I know.
It's great. So just tell people where they can find you then on your social media and your coaching work.
Absolutely. So you can find me at Africa Brooke with an E at the end on Instagram. And over there as well, if you scroll right down, you can see the post that I was sharing from day one. Everything is still on there. And in terms of my coaching work, so I coach women entrepreneurs through self-sabotage. You can find me either at Africa Brooke or discovery.dive, which is on Instagram as well. And if you have any other questions about this, or if something resonates, I'm always welcome to kind of get a voice note through Instagram as
Brilliant.
Well.
Africa, thank you so much, and thank you for the amazing work
you're
doing.
You.
It's such an inspiration, and I'm sure there are so many people whose lives have been changed. They see you as like, oh wow, she looks really cool. Let's see what she's got to say. And that's just great. You know, the role modeling that you're doing there is brilliant. So
I just spoke recently
on the podcast about how Elton John, of course, completely different generation, but I was we all know about his 29 years.
Wow.
But what I hadn't realized was just how many people's lives he's impacted. I mean, loads and loads and loads of celebs he's inspired and mentored through sobriety,
you know.
And it's obviously such a thing for him. It's just the thing he does, you know. He just people and celeb. And I knew that he'd mentored Eminem, but I hadn't realized there are so many of them. It's incredible, isn't it? So it really is. It never is just about you. It's light you're passing on. You know, it's amazing.
Yes.
So thank you so much for being a guest.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Thanks, Africa. Lovely to interview you on the podcast. It's so brilliant being able to connect with other sober influencers and people who are doing a similar kind of work. But, you know, there's so many different people in this scene now, all doing something a little bit similar, but a little bit different. And everyone in this kind of community, everyone's so generous. There isn't that horrible kind of competition that you find in some other circles. It's really amazing. And I was saying to somebody the other day that I'd interviewed someone else who has a membership site and is and has a podcast and is doing all sorts of things, and I think there are other industries where you might not connect because you might think, oh well, you know, that's competition for me. But I don't know, I don't think anyone in this scene sees it like that at all. It's that lovely thing of all ships rise in high tide, you know, and it really is much more about wanting to share these messages with as many people as possible. And what's great is that, you know, obviously we all sort of resonate with different people's stories. And that's why I love doing this podcast, because because getting to be able to speak to some of these people and share their stories is just, I just absolutely love it. I learn something new every time. I learn something from every guest. And I feel kind of inspired all over again, you know, with that. So it's brilliant. One thing that I've been writing about this week, I've got a new blog post out. If you can read it at the soberclub.com. There's a blog post about being conscious and being woke. You know, that terrible expression. I hate that expression, but everyone uses it now. That thing of how conscious are you really? And it got me thinking about the fact that, you know, there's absolutely no doubt about it. Drinking alcohol really lowers your vibration. And I don't mean that to sound completely woo-woo, but it really does. It really dampens everything down. And when I use the word conscious, you know, obviously I don't mean are you unconscious, although sometimes, of course, when you're drinking, you are. but it's just that thing of being alive and awake. And we've been speaking so much recently within our Facebook group about just how much you can get done when you're not drinking. It's incredible. And it's not only the big things. I know we talk a lot about the big things, but it's the little things. It's the booking the dental appointment and taking the bag to the charity shop that's been by the door for ages, or in the car, or it's the little things. And there's an amazing sense of accomplishment, you know, when you can get some of those little things done. It's really, really special. Anyways, I've got some great guests coming up. I always say that because I have. I'm really so fortunate. Dale Pinnock, the medicinal chef, is going to be a guest with us. And who else have I got coming up? Star Keshera, who does a whole thing about beauty and where that links to ditching the booze. So that's another great interview. And then Darren Taylor is going to be on the show. I've got lots of great guests. And of course, I'm always open to your suggestions. If you want to drop me an email, make sure you follow me on Instagram. It's at Janie Lee Grace. And you can always drop me an email as well. And just a reminder that our Champneys break is still available. There are still some rooms left. There was that mistake on the system. So if you looked at it and thought, oh, it's way too expensive, it's mad. It was because they didn't have the rooms available on the site, as it were, but they do now. So you can find the link at thesoberclub.com. Just check out under events and you'll see that there. It's January the 11th to the 12th. It's going to be a fantastic wellness break. We're also planning another retreat at Inner Guidance. This is the one that we launched last year. It's happening at the end of January, the first one. That was the one that sold out within about 24 hours. So I really hope that more of you get to sign up for this one. If you'd like to, we're going to be running it in May. So we'll be launching that very soon. You're welcome to register your interest with me if you know you want to do that. It's at Inner Guidance in Suffolk. It's going to be a fantastic event. I think that's it for this week. Don't forget, you're very welcome to come and join us in the Sober Club. Just to make it really clear, thesoberclub.com is a website where you can find all the podcasts and you can find the blogs. And sometimes there's some competitions there and an events page. And then there's also a membership side of it. If you'd like to become a member, you're very welcome. And then that includes you get our 90-day online course, Get the Buzz Without the Booze, and a whole raft of amazing experts and content and trainings, and our exclusive Facebook group as well. So I just hope that's clear for you, and I look forward to seeing you same time next week. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast. I'm Jenny Lee Grace. Please go to thesoberclub.com, listen to more podcasts, read our blogs, enter our competitions, grab yourself a free PDF, Self-Care in Sobriety, and check out our online community,